third annual YIED Queen's Chuba Lecture, which is in memory of Ari and Sarn Horowitz and Michelle. Ari and Sarn moved to our community almost 20 years ago, and they were with us for a short 15 years. Previously, Ari had been on the Yai and served in the IDF, coming back to the U.S. only on Shlichut. He met Sarn in the office of the Jewish Agency here in New York, and it was literally love at first sight. He went on to get married and make Aliyah. Sadly, due to the tragic death of Ari's brother, Natan, they had to come back to the U.S. to be with Ari's parents in Philadelphia. Then they came to East Brunswick, and they immediately made a huge impact on our community. Their passions for both this community and the state of Israel touched every single member of our shul, serving on shul boards and much more. When Ari was president, he ran the Freedom Campaign to pay off the shul mortgage. But most important was their love of the land and the people of Israel. They organized 3 shul missions during difficult times, such as the Intifada. And they were involved in tzedakah on a regular basis, in very quiet ways. They believed very strongly in Talmud Torah, even supporting Chavrei Kollel and Chevron, whom they paid monthly to sit and learn on their behalf. Very sadly, they were tragically taken from us on the way home from Shul on the Shabbos before Rosh Hashanah, a short 6 years ago. Tonight, besides learning and inspiration and tshuva, should be zuchus in their memory. They should have an aliyas neshama from our learning, our tshuva on their behalf. We're very, very fortunate to have with us Rabbi Shai Shachter. When Rabbi Shachter came first to YU, I remember very clearly there was a big roshan, a very big impact on the B'nai Yeshiva then. And it became immediately clear why. Because he's such a kind, generous person. And his relative youth relies on tremendous Torah scholarship. It's been really a privilege of mine to know Rabbi Shachter, to be with him at Rabbinic Yarchakala, and I've learned tremendously from him in the few short years that I've known him. He received smicha from both his illustrious father of Shachter and also of Asher Weiss, 2 Gedole Olam. He formerly served as a rabbi at the White Shul in Far Rockaway and is now one of the rabbanim on staff at the Israel of Whitney. It's a tremendous cover that he has come to our community just because of who he is. And also it's important that he's here, I think, on a personal level, because back when the accident happened 6 years ago, Rabbi Shachter was a tremendous support to Sam Nash and really was personally involved in helping him through that traumatizing period. And for that reason, not only is he a very special individual to have here on any day, but specifically today, when we're commemorating the passing of Ari and Sarah Horowitz. He was so important to the family at that time, and he's truly the right person to speak to me. And thank you all for coming to hear his Tzivut Torah, and I'm very, very honored to have you.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much, Rabbi Interman, and all those who are here this evening. It's a moving experience to be asked to travel out to speak on an occasion like this one. And one obviously has to have mixed feelings. We have feelings of recollection, feelings of introspection at the same time. But we have feelings of great pride in the fact that this community continues to grow, that this community does not hold itself back, because of terrible tragedy that may have happened, and that this community continues to be a bastion of light for the various communities that are surrounding you. And I can only say, in the 2 years that Rabbi Unterman has been here, we've been in contact a little bit here and there via email, and it's always a great pleasure. I hope you continue as a community to have great milestones together with him and with each other. We should only come back here to celebrate great and wonderful things that this community will be known for in the future. So I've been asked to speak this evening about some aspects of tshuva, some important thoughts that we should consider as we live through this process of repentance. We're on the cusp, obviously, of Yom HaKippurim. And we have so much that we need to think about, and I'm just going to share my very humble perspective of the way I will be entering into this Yom HaKippurim, of the way I will be thinking as we come into this season of year, and as we try to successfully ensure ourselves of a Gemara Chasima Tova. So we look, obviously, at the Rambam. The Rambam is the first place that we often look when we try and figure out how we're supposed to have the proper perspectives about tshuva. After all, the Rambam has a number of chapters in which he describes what the procedure of tshuva is meant to be about. And in that description, the Rambam writes something very interesting. The Rambam tells us that God looks down every year on his beautiful world, and he looks at the various communities all over the world. And some of them he looks and he sees are righteous and virtuous communities, and others God sees are corrupt and immoral societies. And at some of them, obviously, God looks with great pride and tremendous satisfaction. And there are other communities in which God looks at them with tremendous frustration and extreme disappointment. And the Rambam says that God begins to hesitate. And he wonders, should I really continue to sustain this insane world? Look around. Who doesn't believe that our world is so insane? You don't have to go to Israel to see what human beings are willing to do to create such havoc, such devastation, like we just learned of this morning. Ari Fold actually was in our community a few months ago speaking. My brother is very close with his brother. I feel very connected, even though I didn't have a personal relationship with him. But we should all feel connected. Somebody called me today to discuss this terrible, terrible story. And he said, did you know who it was? And then he caught himself and he said, why does it matter who it was? Do you not feel like a brother? Don't you see what has happened to our people? It's an insane world. And the Rambam writes that God hesitates, and he's not exactly sure what he should do. Should this crazy society and all of humanity as we know it continue to be nourished, continue to be sustained? Or perhaps God says it's time for it to come to an end. And after God goes through the very careful calculation and he deliberates, the Rambam writes, then he comes to the conclusion that it seems that the balance between virtue and iniquity seems to be somewhat equal. And it's dependent on the individual as to whether or not the world is worthy of being sustained, or perhaps God should decide otherwise. I've always found this Rambam to be very puzzling. I've heard it many times. I don't quite understand it. Does that really happen? Do I really stand on top of a balanced world and make such a difference? Is that really the way our world works? What does the Rambam mean? And how is that to be understood? And that's what I'd just like to spend a few moments of introductory comment to understand what this means, which will lead us into our next point. Just a few weeks ago, we read the Torah portion in which we have a great description of the city that has, I guess you can say, taken a leap of faith in the wrong direction. The Ir HaNidachas. You have a regular city, Jews who are serving God, Jews who feel connected Jews who have built schools, who have built an infrastructure, who have built supermarkets and everything that a Jewish community can ever ask for. And suddenly the entire city is swept up and begins to serve Avodah Zarah. What does God tell us? God tells us that our communal response to that city has to be unconditional intolerance. And God says we must destroy the city. There can be no remnant of its existence. Everybody has to know that this is what happens when you have a city that goes off the rails, when you have a city that begins to serve Avodah Zarah. There cannot be a trace of this city's existence. Now the psukim there describe the beginnings of this unfortunate downfall of the city. And we're told, Yasku Anashim B'nei Belial, which simply translated means, they were a group of villains that went out into the city and began this whole movement toward Avodah Zarah, toward idol worship. But listen to an amazing Gemara Masechta Sanhedrin, where we're given a very different perspective. Yatzku Anashim B'nei Belial writes the Gemara, Miut Anashim Shnayim. When our pasuk, when our verse describes how this whole city began with its horrible trajectory, how did the story begin? You know how? Yatzku Anashim B'nei Belial. All it takes to wipe an entire city off the map is two people. Two nefarious men can come into a city, can begin one by one to convince a people of a new way of life, and that's enough to create a negative culture that can ultimately wipe an entire city off the map. Will you ever doubt again the power and the unique potency of an individual? How many of us travel throughout the year in the various airports all over the world? And I can tell you myself, I'm frustrated every time I go through a security checkpoint. Do I really need to wait on these long lines to be checked? Do I really need to take my shoes off and my belt? And then I need to be patted down? You know, I look like a terrorist. And I always wonder, it's so frustrating. And why is it that my suitcase needs to be rummaged through? Such an invasion of my privacy. All because they're concerned about a tube that might have some toothpaste in it, hiding in my suitcase. Why all of this horrible profiling? Why do we have to live through this? You know why? Why do I take my shoes off? Maybe you're hiding a liquid bomb in your shoe. Let me tell you something. Why do we do all of this? Because one time, in one period of history, there was one completely insane and crazy individual on one corner of the globe who decided that he's going to hide a liquid bomb in his shoe. Look what one person has done for our entire world. And we all suffer the consequence. Look at the impact. Look at the influence of one individual, of one human being. Just last week on Rosh Hashanah, we all read the story in Shul of Elkanah and his wife Hannah. Elkanah was the Gadol HaDor, he was the leader of the generation. His wife unfortunately cannot conceive, she had no children, she was so upset, she was depressed. And we all know the story. Ultimately she prays, she ends up having a child. We'll get back into the story in a few minutes. But there's a backdrop here that often goes unnoticed. You see, Elkanah lived at a time in history where people had no interest in visiting the house of God in Shiloh. We have a mitzvah 3 times a year to visit the house of God and to spend some time with him. Nobody was interested. It was dangerous. It wasn't in style. It wasn't the thing to do. And Elkanah was the only one who chose to perform that mitzvah the way he was supposed to. Listen to an amazing comment that the Medrash makes about Elkanah and his pilgrimage to Shiloh to visit the house of God. Elkanah haya ola l'regel. Elkanah did as he was supposed to. He went 3 times a year to visit the house of God and he stayed there. However, as he was traveling on his way to reach Shiloh, he would rest in the town square, refused to take out a hotel, refused to knock on a door. He parked his entire family right in the middle of the town square. And the community was so moved. The community was so impressed. And they all went over to him early in the morning and they asked him, why are you here? And he would say, where else am I going? God instructed us to go and visit his home 3 times a year. That's where I'm headed. That's where I'm going. Miyad, says the Medrash, immediately upon hearing that, Einayim nishagros demoz, they were so overwhelmed by what they heard, and they asked him, Nelech imachem, do we have the right to join you? Va'omer lahem hein, absolutely. This is why I came to sleep right in the middle of the town square. I wanted that everyone should notice me. Abdeshana haba, says the Medrash, the next year he had chamisha batim. 5 families came along. L'shana acheres, asar batim. The subsequent year he had 10 families who joined. Ad, until ultimately, hayu kulam olim. He transformed an entire generation. Because one family, because one man, understood the power of an individual. One man was willing to be bold and one man was willing to be strong. And you can live a whole life running a mission by yourself. But if you believe in the power and the potential of the individual, look what you can accomplish. This is perhaps a reason why we read the story on Rosh Hashanah. It's not only because we want to highlight the aspect of prayer, we want to speak about how Hannah poured her heart out to God and ultimately was blessed with a child. But we want to remind ourselves of the power of how much the individual can accomplish in a lifetime. Look at what Elkanah was able to do. You look at the concluding story in Parsha Shoftim, and it cannot be a coincidence that all of the parshios leading up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom HaKippurim have something very important to teach us. You look in Parsha Shoftim and we're told about the homeless man who's found outside of a city. There is nobody to claim his body. He seems to have no relatives. We don't know anything about his whereabouts. We know nothing about his background. We know nothing about his contribution to the world. And yet, the Torah tells us that the leaders of the neighboring city are expected to go out of their own confines. They're expected to go out and perform a ceremony over his body for a man that we know nothing about. I would assume he was a homeless, drunken man, sleeping on the side of the road, nobody to care for him, has no family. And yet, the leaders of the generation need to go out and take care of this issue. Because we as Jews believe in the power of every individual. We believe that every person has the ability to change the world and to make it a better place. To make our world different than it was before we got here. So this is what the Rambam writes, is the most basic and the most central theme to what Tshuva is all about. For a person to take time to think about what difference they can make in the world, about how they can make the world a better place than it was before they got there. And to consider every once in a while how much we can positively influence our surrounding, our community, our family, and ourselves. So how do we do this as human beings? How really are we expected to make the most of the lives and the opportunities that we're given throughout our time in this earth and throughout the experience that we have in God's beautiful world? Let's begin with the very first human being. God's own creation. I think that would probably be a great place to learn from. An important place to study. So what happens? God, as we know, creates Adam HaRishon. Puts him into the most pristine and beautiful place in the world. And Adam HaRishon succumbs to sin. Adam Rishon, after he eats from the Eitz Hadas, we're told a remarkable conversation that he has with God. One fine day, he violates an Avera, the only one thing that he was asked to follow, he couldn't listen to. Vayikra Elokim El HaAdam, God calls out to Adam HaRishon, Vayomer Lo Ayeka, and he says to Adam HaRishon, where are you? Now Rashi finds this very troubling. God doesn't know where Adam HaRishon is. So Rashi comments, and it was just a way of engaging him in conversation. Of course God knows where he is. But he just wants to get the attention of Adam HaRishon. But if you look in some of the other commentaries on that pasuk, one of them being the Yalshiv, he writes that this is not to be understood in a geographical context. God didn't have trouble locating Adam HaRishon. This question of God was one that was meant to be a character assessment, a character evaluation. So God calls out to Adam HaRishon and he says, where are you, Adam? I created you, like the Gemara says, misofa olam v'yatsofa. You had such a vast intellect. The scope and the purview of your life was so expansive. I gave you all the tools to be so successful in life. I put you in the most beautiful place in the world. How is it that in your very first opportunity, you have already succumbed to sin? Ayeka, where are you, Adam HaRishon? How have you fallen so low? After all that I've invested in you, after all that I've put into this beautiful creation that is the great Adam HaRishon. In the Sefer Sipuri Chassidim, Rav Zevin writes the story about the great Bala Tanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, when he was jailed on one occasion in Russia. So a jail warden comes over to him one day, he says, do you really believe in this Bible? Do you believe in this God? He says, yes. He says, well, I got a problem with the very first story that the Torah tells us. How can it be that you believe in a God that can't even locate one human being? He created one person. He can't find him? Ayeka? How is this to be understood? And the Bala Tanya turns back to this jail warden and he says, I'll explain to you very simply. God was not looking for Adam HaRishon on that occasion. God was rather speaking to the eternal and to the immortal man. And God expects man in every generation to be able to have the courage to ask him or herself every so often, Ayeka, where are you? What are my perspectives on life? Where is my attention? Where do I put my focus? What is important to me? What are my list of priorities when I think about all of the experiences of life? God says from the very first human being, I want all of you to know that you need to make time to ask yourself that penetrating question of Ayeka. Every so often, just to stop oneself and ask, where am I? I'm so lost. I've lost all of my perspective and where I should be headed and where I'm supposed to be going and what I'm supposed to be accomplishing and how much I can do. And as Jews, it's very important that we collectively ask ourselves every so often that question of Ayeka. So just a few weeks ago, I spent some time with my wife for our second summer in one of the most uplifting and exhilarating places in the world. I was asked the last two summers to be the camp rabbi in Camp Simcha. For those who might not know what Camp Simcha is, I give you a blessing. You should never have to know what it is. But they have two sessions for young children who have cancer, and they have another two sessions for young children who are battling all kinds of chronic and physical disabilities. Last summer, we had the opportunity to spend time with the cancer session, and this summer, we were with Camp Simcha Special, which is for many, many physically challenged young women. Some of them are in wheelchairs, some of them are blind, some of them are deaf, many of them are on feeding tubes and trachs, but all of them have the most infectious smiles And all of them are the most amazingly positive spirits. I have no other way to describe this. It's the happiest place in the world. So, I feel every summer that I've been there, that this is God's way of waking me up and forcing me to ask myself a question of, Ayeka, where are you, Schefter? What are your perspectives on life? Do you understand the seriousness of life? Do you understand that life is so much bigger than just yourself? So over the 2 weeks that I was there, I met with many, many of the 128 girls who were on the campus. And I wrote down some of the inspiring moments that I had with them. And everything I share with you is with their permission. But it helped me give perspective for the young Naran. And I hope some of their words will be helpful to you as well. So there was a young woman this summer who had an extremely severe case of angioedema. I don't know if everybody here knows what that is. I certainly had no idea what it was until I was there this summer, where she had almost daily episodes of internal swelling that one cannot even see. She just feels it. And she lives with an absolute fear that if she's not treated within a very short period of time from when she starts to feel the swelling, she can very quickly have the swelling in her throat and she can die from suffocation. This is what the girl lives with every day. So she came to speak to me one day, and in the course of conversation, she said the following. Listen carefully. These are her words. People in our world have it all wrong. All they have to learn, Rabbi, is that hard is not bad. Hard is just hard. Profound. 16-year-old girl. Hard is not bad. Hard is just hard. I watched this summer how a completely secular girl from Israel was there on the campus walking hand in hand with a visibly Hasidish young woman from Brooklyn. And I couldn't really hold myself back. Maybe I should have. But I went over to them and I asked, how this beautiful relationship developed? How could it be that two people from such different communities have developed such a close friendship? This is what they said. We do not think for a second about how much our parents and our communities hate each other. We don't focus on our community's great divides and on our differences, because we chose to focus solely on our tremendous similarities and our shared experiences that we have as human beings. I said to myself, how come I don't have the ability to do that? Why can't I put aside all the issues that I have with so many other communities and just focus on the shared experiences that we have as human beings and just love everyone and accept them for who they are? So there was a girl there from Israel who has no legs, but she's from the most energetic young women I've ever seen. Amazing. And she said, I've learned that there's no judging anyone in the world. We all have our own personal challenges. Mine happens to be physical. Some others out there might have spiritual challenges. But we just need to learn how to take people for who they are and appreciate that they all live life with complicated struggles and with very difficult challenges. A 17-year-old girl, wheelchair-bound, got up in front of the entire camp and shared the following story. No idea where she got it from. I don't know where she gets her inspiration from, but she was an inspiration to me. She spoke about a king who hired 10 workers to plant his fields. And each of them was given just a bucket and the path to go from the well to the field. One of those workers very quickly realized that he was given a broken vessel, that his bucket could not hold water, And he was upset that he couldn't do the job that he was asked and he was trusted to do. Finally, he musters up the courage to go to the king and to discuss with him what he was expected to do. And he finally admits his inability to do the job that the king entrusted him with. At which point the king takes him on a walk and he says, "Come, I'd like you to come with me and watch. I needed that all the flowers that were planted on that road from the well to the field, I needed all of those to be planted as well. I needed those to be watered. Look at the rows and rows of beautiful flowers that only you were able to take care of." And she said, "I've lived so much of my life being angry at God for making me a broken vessel in his world. I've been troubled by my inability to do what so many other people in the world have the ability to do. But I finally have the ability to see the beautiful flowers that only I, as a broken vessel, am able to plant along the road." Amazing perspectives. There was a young woman, I won't bore you, but I'll share one final story. There are hundreds more. There was a young woman, Deborah, from South Bend, Indiana, who unfortunately was very quickly going blind. And her doctors told her that within the next 4 months she would go entirely blind and never be able to see again due to her illness that she had. And after spending weeks trying to internalize what that would mean for her and her family, her parents finally mustered up the courage and said to her, "We're devastated. We're broken. We have nothing to say. But what we do want to do is take you anywhere in the world that you'd like to go before that happens. Tell us. We'll spend any amount of money. We'll let you enjoy it. Just tell us what you want in these last few months that you're able to see." What I found amazing about her response, more amazing than the response itself, was that she doesn't realize how amazing it is. She thinks this is normal. She thinks any 16-year-old girl would say the same thing. And without hesitating for a minute, she said, "How can I go through my entire life without ever having the opportunity to see the land of Israel? I don't want the Alps. I don't want Disney World. None of it matters to me. How can I live a life on this earth without ever having the opportunity to see what the land of Israel means for the Jewish people?" I said to myself, I've gone dozens of times to visit Israel. I jump off the plane. I visit my friends. I go to a restaurant. I'm excited to be there. Have I ever once connected to the land of Israel the way this girl did? Do you know that she spent 10 days doing nothing there, just traveling around? She wanted to see every city in the country. No activities. I just want to take in the beauty, and I want to take in the gift that God has given our generation. Listen to all of this. Incredible courage, unbelievable passion of these young women, and ask yourself that question again. I yet. That penetrating question. Where am I? What are my perspectives on life? We as gods, Achreinu L'chaim, give us all life. That's what we ask for. And God says back to us, I'm more than happy to do so. You're all deserving, you're all worthy. Kulam Anuvim, you're all beloved. But do you ever make time in your life to ask the godly question that I asked the very first human being? What is really important to you in your life? Where do you place your focus and your attention throughout your experiences in life? What do you value and what do you consider to be significant and important to give time and effort to? And what perhaps is worth learning to overlook and just just so insignificant in the grand scheme of life. This is one way to develop the sense of purpose, the sense of passion, the sense of meaning that one human being, that one individual can have on this world. Let's now move to step two. You know, some of the most renowned ethicists of our generation have grappled with the following ethical question. Do we assume that men are really born evil, or should we assume that men become evil over time? Do we assume that human beings shape events, or do we assume that human beings are shaped by world events? So if you had the opportunity to go back in history and kill a 5-year-old Adolf Hitler, or to kill a 10-year-old Osama bin Laden and save the world from the horrible destruction that he has brought about in our world, a decade of terrorism that we've been fighting, or how about if you were able to stop any of the other horrific monsters throughout our history, would that be something that would be looked at as an atrocious crime against humanity and civilization? Would that be a ruthless act, or would that be something that we would look at as a positive act to rid the world of this horrific body of people that seem to want nothing more than just utter destruction? So just a few weeks ago, in Parshas Kisetze, we read the story of the Ben Sora Mohr. The story of the child who's embezzled money from his parents, and he involved himself in excessive eating habits, and he's living a life that's unbecoming of a young Jewish man. And in what would seem to be almost a callous and unsympathetic response, the Torah tells us that you should have no mercy on that child, that we immediately take the life of that young man and we kill him before he has a chance to do anything worse. And the Gemara finds this very troubling. Have you never come across a child who just doesn't know the limitations, who doesn't know boundaries, who doesn't quite know what's appropriate and what's not, who steals a little bit, who does something wrong, a little mischievous? Really? Is that supposed to be our response to such children? Get rid of them? Don't give them a chance? Don't try to teach them? And the Gemara says, yes. That child is nidon al shem sofo. We project into the future. We consider what path this child is going to be living on, and based on that projection alone, we take the child's life now. It would seem to be that the Torah's perspective is we have a right to judge people based on our predictions of their lives in the future. Let's now remind ourselves of the story we read on Rosh Hashanah. And it's troubling on many levels. We read the story of Hagar and Ishmael. Painful story of a woman who gets thrown out of the home of Avraham Avinu. There's no obvious or immediate plan for their survival. They're not provided with food. She ends up in the desert. Just a short time later, she realizes that her child is going to die. And the Medrash tells us that a tremendous disagreement breaks out between God himself and the angels. And the angels say, why not rid the world of this horrific monster? Do you not know who Yishmael is? Do you not know what he's created? Do you not know how much he's destroyed? And God says, absolutely not. Ki shamar Elokim el kol hanar ba'asher husham. At this point in his life, he's not deserving of death. We're going to judge him now by the way he is right now. And we have no right to do anything different. Which leads us back to our question again. What is the Torah perspective on this ethical dilemma? Do we have a right to judge human beings by our prediction that we see into the future? Or do we assume that human beings should be judged at face value, at what we see right now? So let's go back and study the story of the Ben Sora Mohr once again. And perhaps by looking carefully at one key phrase that I think probably goes unnoticed, perhaps we can gain a better understanding into this question and how the Torah responds to it. You see, God certainly understands that every human being has their own sets of weaknesses. God created us with all of those. He made all of our inadequacies, and He knows it. He made all of our deficiencies. We say in our davening, Ve'ata yodei yitzram, ki hein basar v'dam. You created all of us. You know what we stand for, and you know what we are lacking in. You know our deficiencies better than we do. There's nothing wrong with that. Because Adam in Salik Ba'aretz Asher Yasa Tova Lo Yeh. There is no human being that can claim that they are perfect. There is no one that can say that they've never made a mistake. We're all human beings. Kihem Basar Adam. It's the fact of life. And God says it's acceptable. It's okay. Provided that you're willing to be a listener. Provided that at some point in your life, whenever you're ready to do so, you're agreeable to be positively influenced by others. You're agreeable to own up to a mistake. But if a human being considers him or herself to be totally shunted from any sort of effect that they can be influenced by others, then God says there is no possibility for change for that human being ever. Look back at the two stories, and you will find the following. Yishmael, his very name connotes a sense of his uncanny ability to be a shomea. He knows how to listen. Yes, down the line is maybe. Are we going to see horrific outcome from his children? Maybe. Has he done many things wrong? Yes. Is there anyone in this room who can say they haven't done something wrong in their lives? He's a shomea. He's a listener. And somebody who has that ability to listen is always given the opportunity for another chance at life, because they can always perfect, they can always enrich, and they can always further develop the lives that they live. Look back at the story of the Ben Sora and Mora, and you will notice how many times the verse Einenu Shomea is used. The way we are introduced to this child is Einenu Shomea Bikoleinu. He has closed himself off from listening, and God says, if you believe that you are no longer impressionable, if you believe that you can never be affected again by another human being, if you have developed that kind of mindset, God says, you are doomed to absolute failure in life. You will never recognize what you can accomplish in your own life, because you will never deal with any mistakes that we are all prone to make throughout our own respective lives. And this, I believe, is why in Rosh Hashanah it's such an incredible focus that we put on the shofar. We try and develop our sense of listening. Do I really have the ability to listen? Am I so obstructed that I can't even hear anymore? What is normal out there? What's considered to be the right, and what perhaps is the wrong? Have I lost all sense of direction? Do I have the ability to be a shomea? No other mitzvah in the Torah do you find that we perform the mitzvah 30 days before other than the mitzvah of shofar. It takes a lot of work to learn how to be a listener. It doesn't happen overnight. We give ourselves 30 days to practice this art of listening, because it's such a difficult task for human beings to learn how to listen. And when we talk about the story of Hagar and Ishmael, let me just make one final comment. When I was in the Kollel Elyon in YU, a time that I have such fond memories of, it was a time that I was with Rabbi Unterman when we were both studying in yeshiva. Best years of our lives, I would say, so far. And one of the great benefits that we had in this program was we had lunch every Thursday afternoon with Dr. Lamb. And he always shared his incredible insights with our small group. And he would invite many prominent leaders from all over the world to meet with us. And it was just an amazing opportunity. When I was going out to my first position in the White Shul, Rabbi Lamb shared a thought with me that, quite frankly, I have thought about so often since that time. Because it so much shaped everything that I aspire to do in my life, everything that I hope to accomplish in the very simple life that I live. And he told me about three women who were put through extremely challenging circumstances. Each one of them was moved to tears because of their experience, but there's an important distinction between these three storylines. And the three women that we refer to are Hagar, Rachel, and Chana. Listen carefully to the three stories. Hagar, as we just mentioned, was thrown out of the home of Avraham Avinu. And what are we told when she notices that her child is about to lose his life? Painful, difficult. A parent losing a child is not the way the world is supposed to run. And Hagar is faced with tragedy. What are we told? And I'll translate. Vatelech, and she positions herself. Vateshav la mineged, and she stands at a distance. Harchei kemetacha vikesha, she does not want to be too close. Ki amra, because she said to herself, Al ereh b'mos hayeled, I do not want to see the death of my child Ishmael. He's my child. Vatesha mineged, and she sits away at a distance. Vatisa eskola vatev, and she begins to cry for the loss of her child. The second being Rachel Imenu, as we're told in the Navi, she has a vision of her children going through this horrific exile, all the experiences that we as a people have lived through. So bitter, so gruesome, so painful. And we're told, Rachel Bebaka Avanea, Me'anali Hinachem. She refuses to be consoled because there is no consolation you can give such a person. Albaneha ki enenu, because her children are not in their own land, because they're wandering through the exile, they're being persecuted, they're being murdered, they're being killed. And the third being Chana. Vatispalel al Hashem vihi maras nefesh. She was so deeply depressed. If you've ever dealt with a couple who deals with infertility, you understand exactly what this means. Vihi maras nefesh. She was so depressed. Vatispalel al Hashem v'chosivkeh, and she begins to cry uncontrollably. How do you console a woman who sees that there's no hope? Who's been told that there are no more options? Who's tried everything? Who's davened for years? Who's tried every medical treatment in the book? Who's been to every specialist and every doctor, every hospital? And just can't do it. So he pointed out that there's a dramatic difference between these three stories, and that is the following. How did each of these three women seek the solution to their problem? Let's go once again to the story of Hagar, who decides that the way she's going to deal with her problem is the natural defense mechanism that we so often choose to use, and that is denial. I know it's happening. I see it. But I just close my eyes and I walk away. I can't face it. It's too difficult. Who wants to live looking at the eye of difficulty, at the eye of tragedy? Who wants to live through such an experience and watch it as it unfolds? Hagar chose the route of denial. Just pretend like it's not happening. Close your eyes and walk away. Rachel Imenu, we're told, also, Mivaka Albanea, she begins to cry and she cannot be consoled. But no mention is made in the psukim themselves. We have all kinds of midrashim, but no mention is made in the psukim themselves of her proactively doing anything about it. So yes, the Gemara says she tried to negotiate with God. But in truth, all we're told in the psukim is that she has a vision. Maybe someday the Shavu Banim Ligvulam. Maybe someday my children will be worthy again on their own and return to this land. Maybe the exile will end because they'll be worthy. I can't do anything about it. I'm very pained by it. I see it. I'm watching it happen. I'm experiencing it. I'm there with them. But all I can do is dream for their future. There is no actual, there's no immediate action taken on her part. You look at the third individual, and that is Chana. What response does Chana have? Vatidor neder vatomar. Chana stands up on that occasion and she makes a promise to God. And she says, Imrao tireba ani amasecha, if you will see, if you will finally recognize the plight of your humble, of your inadequate servant, Uzachar tani, and you will remember me. Velo sishkach es amasecha, then she tells God, Vinasatin lahashem kol yimei chayav, and I promise I will give him over to God for the rest of his life. I will dedicate him to you. Chana stands up and does something about the problem that she's facing. She's faced with a very moving experience, but she responds by taking action. She responds by doing something positive, by doing something proactive to change the fate that she finds herself in. And he told me at that time that you're going to live through life. You're going to experience lots of personal and communal opportunities. Some of them will be positive, some of them will be negative, but many of them will be extremely moving. Many of them will be very inspiring. And you have an opportunity to ask yourself on every one of those occasions and to choose how you are going to respond, how you are going to deal with the moment that you are now facing. Some of us will choose to be like Hagar. Move on with life. It's not relevant. You can watch a funeral like I just watched on my way here of a tzaddik who's killed in Gush Etzion, whose four children have to now live the rest of their lives without a father. And you can shut it off and say, life goes on. Let's pretend like it never happened. Because it's not me, and it's not my family, and it has no relevance to my life. And who cares that there are hundreds of Jews who are crying and mourning over this loss? There are those of us who choose to respond like Rachel Imenu. We don't believe that we can actually change the lives that we live. We've been moved by a positive experience that we've had. But all we do is dream that maybe someday our grandchildren, maybe their experiences will reflect in some way the experience that I'm having now. Maybe their lives will be changed, but I can't really change my own life. My own life is what it is. But we all have the opportunity to respond and to react like Chana did. To take life into our own hands. To always use those opportunities as moments where we can once again reevaluate, where we can reconsider over and over again the life that we are living as individuals and as a community. We can use these opportunities to become a shomea, to become a listener, to allow ourselves to be impacted, to be influenced. We can use these moments of inspiration to say to ourselves, yes, I will ask myself that godly question that sometimes is difficult to ask. Ayeka, where am I headed in life? What are my perspectives? How different a life am I living after the moment of inspiration that I've just been through? And how good of a listener am I to the many, many areas of life that require listening? And I sometimes think, and with this we'll close. It's 9 o'clock. How good am I at listening to the very honest and sometimes very critical voice of my spouse? It's not easy. But how good are we at that? How good am I as a father at listening to the very worthy calls for attention from my four children? What am I busy with when they're calling for my attention? What in the world is more important in my life than my own children who need me Why am I so busy and finding myself not being able to listen? And how good am I when I have a member of my community who tells me that he's unemployed? An aguna in my community who says she cannot get a gig? A cancer patient in my community who says they need to have a surgery? Somebody who's running out of options for treatment? What about someone who needs a leg amputated and cannot ever get out of their home? How good am I at really sincerely listening to these people and thinking about what I can really do to show them that I've heard them? So I listen and I move on. But how often do I really master the art of listening? And how good am I at listening to the voices of our communal leaders as Jews? It's not always easy. And we live in a world of opportunity. We live in a world of free speech, of free thought. And you can go on the internet or on Facebook and find a contrarian who will convince you of anything. But how good am I at being humble and submitting myself to the voice of our leaders that we all look up to? How good am I at understanding that they're greater than I am? And how good am I at ever asking myself to listen to the voice of my own soul that cries out for direction, that wants my attention, that wants me to stop myself every once in a while in life and say, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you headed? Where are you going? What is your purpose? How much do you plan to accomplish? What do you plan to do in the coming year? As we ask God this season, and on Yom Kippur will be the final time that we will ask Him, Zachareinu L'chaim, please God, remember us for life. Let us also just take the opportunity to ask God for one extra request as well, and that is, God, don't just grant us life. Grant us the opportunity, give us the strength, avail us the fortitude to be able to make the absolute most of the most exalted and uplifting, meaningful lives that all of us are given the opportunity to live. I wish all of you once again a Gemar Chasima Toba, and I hope that we should come together in this community to celebrate life, to celebrate the accomplishments of special individuals, to celebrate together everything that the collective individuals are able to accomplish throughout their time on this earth. And may we all be blessed with the Shnas Geula, the Yeshua, the Shnas Chaim, the Shalom. And thank you, Rabbi Unterman, once again for giving me this great, great privilege of coming here during the Aseret Yemei Teshuva. And I look forward to continuing to have a great relationship in our Avodas HaKodesh that we try our best to accomplish. Shana Tova to everyone.